Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday, January the 9th. Today, interest rates have hit an all-time low.
We clearly are heading very rapidly close to zero here, and the question then also for the Bank of England and the Treasury is what you do when you do get to zero.
Also today, diplomatic efforts continue for a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. The bombing continues.
Israeli officials have been to Cairo on Thursday, and it seems that talks are continuing and there's continuing negotiations going on at the UN. But I fear that we are several days away yet from an agreement to end the conflict.
And the French Justice Minister, Rachida Dati, returns to work just 5 days after giving birth by caesarean section.
Being a cabinet minister means you have to be available at all times, and that seems to be what she wants to be doing. She's showing no signs of slowing down.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a flick through today's papers with Sandy Waugh.
The UN Security Council has passed a resolution urging an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, with the US alone abstaining. The UK-drafted resolution also calls for a full Israeli withdrawal, unimpeded humanitarian access and intense diplomatic efforts for peace. Israeli bombing continued last night, killing at least 6 Palestinians. This is according to medics and Hamas officials. We'll be hearing from The Guardian's correspondent in Jerusalem later in the programme. The incoming Obama administration said they're prepared to talk to Hamas, although there is no talk of Obama approving direct diplomatic negotiations with Hamas early on. He's being urged by advisers to initiate low-level or clandestine approaches. Al-Qaeda's operations chief in Pakistan and another top aide are believed to have been killed. Osama al-Kini and his lieutenant Sheikh Ahmed Salim Sweden were both killed in recent days, according to US counter-terrorism officials. Al-Kini was believed to be behind last year's deadly attack on the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad. Both al-Qaeda suspects died in South Waziristan on Pakistan's border with Afghanistan. Mortgage lenders are warning Gordon Brown that his scheme to prevent a surge in home repossessions could stifle new home loan lending, despite yesterday's cut in interest rates from the Bank of England to an historic low of 1.5%. The UK's biggest providers are under pressure from the government over their reluctance to pass on the full benefits of reductions in the cost of borrowing. They've told ministers the cost of providing a payment holiday for hard-pressed borrowers would limit their ability to grant fresh loans. The European Union says gas supplies should restart after it struck a deal with Russia on supervising the flow of gas through Ukraine. But officials couldn't say when many homes and businesses across Europe could turn on their heating again after 2 days without gas during freezing winter weather. Russia cut off the natural gas it sends to Europe through Ukraine on Wednesday when a payment dispute escalated. Russia claims Ukraine siphoned off gas for its own use. Ukraine denies this. Look at this morning's papers now. The Guardian leads with the exclusive story that the Obama camp are ready to open dialogue with Hamas. The Times looks at President-elect Obama's economic strategy. Obama said yesterday that only unprecedented and urgent government spending could prevent the deepening recession stretching for years into the future. The front page of the Financial Times reveals further details regarding the Bernard Madoff case. Madoff ordered his UK company to transfer £100 million to his US firm just weeks before he confessed to running a $50 million fraud scheme. The Daily Telegraph looks at the Bank of England's warning that more may need to be done for Britain's economy. And The Independent says the business world is losing confidence in Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The Bank of England cut interest rates yesterday by half a percentage point to 1.5%. That's the lowest level in the bank's 315-year history. Only 3 months ago, the base rate stood at 5%. Yet some business leaders had called for a full percentage point cut. I asked our head of business, Dan Roberts, if yesterday's move was too timid.
Well, don't forget this has come after some dramatic interest rate cuts in recent months. So I think the question is you have to look at them in the round, and we've gone within a matter of weeks to almost unprecedented levels of interest rate cuts. The question now, I think, is not so much over whether it's another half point, another full point, but whether interest rates are actually an effective tool anymore. You know, some business leaders have been saying actually the issue is not the price of money, not the cost of debt, but the availability of debt. You know, bank lending is still frozen, and until that can get unlocked, actually the price at which you pay for that debt is less and less relevant.
Does that mean that the cuts that we've seen in the last few months, as you say, dramatic cuts, haven't really had much effect? They haven't really got consumer spending again?
My personal view is actually we may be beginning to see the benefits of that. We had a lot of retailers reporting this week, and they're actually not quite as bad as they've been expecting. Some pretty grim numbers out there, people still seeing sales go backwards. But actually, companies like Debenhams and Sainsbury's and John Lewis are finding that it's tough, but it's not meltdown. And I wonder whether some of that may be a reflection of the fact we have seen some very, very sharp falls in interest rates already filtering through. So I think they should stick with it. Ultimately, monetary policy is an important tool. It's just that business leaders are right. There is also a separate problem, which is the banking system remains frozen.
Will interest rates continue to fall?
Yeah, I mean, we clearly are heading very rapidly close to zero here. And the question then also for the Bank of England and the Treasury is what you do when you do get to zero. You know, they have to look at other measures. There's all this talk about printing money out there. There's talk about direct intervention into the bank lending system. You know, these are all things that they're having to think about because they're running out of room as far as interest rates are concerned.
Printing money was dismissed by Alistair Darling yesterday after some newspapers reported that that was what the government was going to do. I mean, this would be a classic kind of Keynesian measure, I suppose, to sort of boost the money supply. What effect would it have, and do you think it'll happen?
Well, I think what was slightly confused is that kind of Zimbabwean Weimar Republic Germany type scenario of people wheeling round barrow loads of fivers is somewhat simplistic. But nonetheless, the government is looking at a version of that, which the economists call quantitative easing, which is a form of basically injecting money directly into the banking system, directly letting the government underwrite loans that companies make from the banks. These are all ways basically of pumping more liquidity into the system to try and get the wheels turning again. They are, you know, the government's right to say that it's a long way from sort of turning on the presses and churning out fivers, but we're not far away from that territory. And I think that there are clear discussions going on in government at the moment about what to do next.
The question that we've been asking every month, Dan, when there's been these interest rate cuts, is whether the banks will pass them on to their customers. I mean, how important is that? And I mean, clearly it's probably not going to happen completely because it hasn't happened in the last few months.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to this question about the availability of finance. You might be able to get some very cheap mortgage deals, although there may be some very cheap mortgage deals around, but you may not be able to get them. I mean, the number of players in the mortgage market, for example, has shrunk dramatically. We saw Bank of Ireland yesterday actually decide not to issue mortgages in the UK market anymore. And these are all examples of the way in which, you know, you can keep cutting interest rates, but if nobody's prepared to lend you money at that level, it doesn't mean very much.
And meanwhile, the backdrop of in the UK economy is looking very bleak. I mean, yesterday we saw Nissan cut 1,200 jobs at its Sunderland plant, about a quarter of its workforce.
Yes, this is a very worrying development because it's a sort of next stage in the crisis, really. It's when the financial crisis has clearly spilt over into consumer demand. We've seen demand for cars drop dramatically in recent weeks. And now that's spilling over into manufacturing, which will spill over into jobs, which can affect consumer demand. And you start to feel this sort of vicious spiral, which is a very familiar part of any recession. I mean, we mustn't forget these are not, these may feel like exceptional times, but this is what happens in recessions. What's alarming is how fast it's happening, and we, you know, only a few months ago everything looked relatively rosy, and now we're into a scenario where car sales have fallen off a cliff, and it's no wonder that Nissan is saying, you know, do we need these people?
Dan Roberts, and we've got more details of yesterday's interest rate cut and the reaction to it at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, how to come back from the ski slopes alive. Phil Doust writes at guardian.co.uk/travel. Olympic hero Bradley Wiggins, MBE, on Beijing, Lance Armstrong and his guitar collection at guardian.co.uk/sport. And we've got pictures of winter birds. The cold snap is forcing some unusual species into Britain's back gardens. See which ones you can spot at guardian.co.uk/environment. There were fears yesterday that the conflict in Gaza could spread. Four rockets were fired into northern Israel from Lebanon yesterday. Hezbollah denied responsibility, saying it wasn't aware of the missiles being fired. Meanwhile, Gaza itself has been hit by intense artillery strikes and waves of aerial bombardment, driving thousands of Palestinians from their homes. A UN relief agency working with Palestinian refugees suspended its operations in Gaza yesterday, saying it was too dangerous. In Jerusalem, for The Guardian, is Rory McCarthy.
Well, Israel's military operation in Gaza continues. We know that there has been heavy artillery strikes and air bombardments throughout the day. For the second time, Israel paused its operations for 3 hours in the afternoon to allow more aid to cross into Gaza. But we also know that there have been complications with that. At least one driver of a truck that was supposed to be collecting aid to be delivered to the UN was shot and two others injured by the Israeli military. This is according to a UN account of events. These are Palestinian contractors who've worked for the UN for years, collecting these sorts of deliveries. So that just indicates how difficult it is to deliver aid in Gaza when this conflict is going on, at a time when there is a very serious humanitarian crisis there and when food and medical supplies are very urgently needed.
Missiles were fired into Israel from Lebanon, Rory. What happened there, and how much of a risk is there of the conflict broadening?
About four rockets were fired into northern Israel early on Thursday morning. This is the first time that there's been any violence in the north of Israel since the conflict in Gaza began. And of course, Israel has been concerned that Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group, might somehow enter the conflict. You remember that Israel fought a very intense war in southern Lebanon 2 years ago against Hezbollah, which resulted in the deaths of hundreds of Lebanese. However, it doesn't seem that these rockets came from Hezbollah. In all likelihood, they came from a smaller group, either a Palestinian faction based in southern Lebanon or simply a group of men operating on their own. And I do not think at this stage that it's likely to escalate.
There have been intense diplomatic efforts ever since Israel began their attacks on Gaza at the end of last month. Rory, are we anywhere nearer to a ceasefire?
That's very hard to answer. I have to say I'm very pessimistic about the diplomacy at the moment. There was a sense earlier in the week, particularly when the French President Nicolas Sarkozy came to the Middle East, there was a sense that real progress was being made. But I'm not sure that that's an accurate assessment of the situation. I think Israel is being very firm on what it wants and before the fighting will end. And those include an arms embargo on Hamas in the future and an end to the smuggling of weapons into Gaza across the Egyptian border. And I think unless Israel gets guarantees on those two issues, that any ceasefire is very unlikely. And it doesn't seem to me that at this stage the diplomacy has reached the level of nailing down those sorts of details. Now, Israeli officials have been to Cairo on Thursday, and it seems that talks are continuing, and there's continuing negotiations going on at the UN. But I fear that we are several days away yet from an agreement to end the conflict.
Did Israel's attack on two UN schools that were being used as civilian shelters on Wednesday have any effect on public opinion in Israel?
I think probably it had more effect on international opinion and may have accelerated the diplomacy a little. But I think on the Israeli side, the Israeli military and the Israeli government have argued very strongly that when incidents like this happen, it's not the fault of the Israeli military, it's the fault of Hamas and other militants from firing near civilian areas. Now, the UN has been very, very tough about this. They're extremely angry for obvious reasons about what happened. We know that in the principal incident in this UN school in Jabalia, in northern Gaza, which is being used as a shelter for Palestinians who've been forced to flee their homes, at least 43 people were killed and about 100 injured. The Israelis initially claimed that militants were firing from within the compound of the school. The UN vigorously denies that and says that it's been told privately by the Israeli military that it no longer believes that to be the case, and it now thinks that the militants were somewhere near the school but not inside the compound.
Rory McCarthy in Jerusalem. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, the National Youth Orchestra celebrates its 60th birthday.
In the late spring, Bychkov is coming back to the UK to conduct Wagner's opera Lohengrin at Covent Garden. He's starting off the year, however, in a school hall just outside Uttoxeter in Staffordshire.
But first, French Minister Rachida Dati has returned to work less than 5 days after giving birth to a baby girl by caesarean section. Well, it's not the first time she's attracted controversy. The 43-year-old is the first person of North African origin to take a senior ministerial post in France. And describing her private life as complicated, she's refused to reveal who the baby's father is. Well, to discuss the implications of going back to work so soon after giving birth by caesarean section is our health editor, Sarah Bosley. And to tell us more about Rachida Dati is our Paris correspondent, Angelique Chrysafis.
Well, if you do the maths, she's actually gone back to work less than 3 working days after giving birth. We've got to remember that she's a huge symbol in France. She's the first Muslim woman of the Moroccan and Algerian community to take a major government post. And she announced at the age of 43 that she was pregnant and she's single and she wouldn't say who the father was, saying that she had a very complicated family life. So she basically gave birth on a Friday in a caesarean section and was back at work on the Wednesday morning.
Sarah Bosley, is there any reason why a woman shouldn't go back to work so soon after giving birth by caesarean section?
Well, it doesn't do you actual physical damage to go back, as long as you're very careful. You'd have to be very careful not to lift heavy weights. You're not supposed to drive for about 10 days. There's a chance that you could bruise the wound and do yourself some damage that way. But the main problems are the emotional, hormonal thing that's going on with giving birth, which is going to last for weeks, and also failing to bond with the child.
Angelique, what's been the reaction in France to her decision to go back to work?
Well, it's very interesting. You have to put it very much in a political context here, because Rachida Dati, of course, was appointed by Nicolas Sarkozy, and she's been in trouble in her justice ministry. She's been criticised by judges. And, of course, the day she chose to go back to work, if choice is the right word here, it's the key word, the day she went back to work on Wednesday, Nicolas Sarkozy was making his own massive announcement reforming the judicial system. So there's both this idea that, on the one hand, here she is being Wonder Woman in a government which is really all about image. And the question is, did she go to work on the Wednesday in order to be photographed looking like this fantastic mother who can juggle everything at once? And will she now actually go off to spend time with a baby? Now, a male member of the cabinet, Luc Chatel, has actually said, well, no, being a cabinet minister means you have to be available at all times. And that seems to be what she wants to be doing. She's showing no signs of slowing down.
And she said that she doesn't want to be a role model for single mothers. But, I mean, it's inevitable that some people will see her as just that.
Let's not forget that there's a whole row brewing over here at the moment of who is the father of this baby? Is there a father of this baby? And is he taking care of it? Of course, Rachida Dati comes from a very big family. She's got a lot of sisters and her mother had many, many children. And she always cites the example of her mother who once went back to work 2 days after giving birth. Now, her mother had intermittent jobs as a cleaning woman. Did she have a caesarean before she went back to work after 2 days? We don't know. But Rachida Dati has often said pregnancy is not an illness. And it sounds like she's really showing that motherhood can be juggled with full-time work as a cabinet minister.
Sarah, what do you think about that?
Well, I think juggling full-time work is fine once you've had about 6 months off to sort yourself out and also get to know your baby, feed the baby. The whole breastfeeding thing, all of that's got to go out the window if she's straight back to work like this. I think most people would say this is a very strange decision and there must be something more to it than simply wanting to keep up with the boys.
Because the benefits of maternity leave are not just the fact that she's had this major operation and needs to rest. I mean, there are many other benefits.
Well, yes, it's the whole business of getting to know your baby, really, and the closeness and the bonding. And breastfeeding, of course, is really important because it has health benefits for the baby in terms of avoiding obesity and all sorts of things like that.
Sarah Bosley. The body's ability to heal itself could be boosted with a new treatment that involves releasing a flood of stem cells from bone marrow into the bloodstream. Victims of broken bones and heart attacks are among those who might benefit from the groundbreaking treatment, which has been developed by researchers at Imperial College London. Well, to explain what they've managed to do, our science correspondent Ian Sample.
What they've managed to achieve is a way of boosting the body's natural repair process quite significantly by administering drugs that cause our bone marrow to release stem cells. Now, these stem cells are often, if we damage ourselves, our bone marrow releases different types of stem cells, which they naturally will home in on the site of damage and start regenerating and regrowing any damaged tissue. What these guys have done is really interesting. They've found a combination of drugs that when you give it, causes a big flood of these stem cells. So instead of just having a very slow and gradual and often quite small repair mechanism going on in your body, you can crank that up probably 100-fold.
And what kind of injuries might such a treatment help to treat?
Well, the stem cells they're releasing can grow into very specific tissue types: blood vessels, cartilage, and bone. So if you have a broken bone and you go into hospital, you could get given these drugs and it would help you have a flood of these stem cells that will help regrow your bone. The other one is obviously for people who go into hospital with heart attacks and they lose some heart cells in the process, that their hearts are damaged, regenerating that sort of tissue as well. So pretty major injuries we're talking about.
And it's quite a novel way of treating these injuries.
It's completely novel. No one's done this before. And that's what I really like about it. It's a really, really big idea to try and do this. People have already worked out a way of getting bone marrow to release stem cells that can only form blood cells. And this is the bedrock of bone marrow transplants for treating leukemia. What you do is you get your donor, you give them a drug, and it releases releases blood stem cells into their bloodstream. You take those and you give them to a person with leukemia. This would allow, this new technique would allow doctors to give patients a drug and almost from this flood of stem cells get their bodies to heal themselves.
Is it still very much at the stage of being a big idea at the moment?
It is. It's very early stages. It's only been done in mice so far, and that's obviously where you start with all of these things. You work up the idea, you try it first in mice. What they're hoping to do later this year is to actually look at how good this treatment is for repairing damage to the heart and repairing damage to bones. After that, it will be a case of trying to get this into humans. So we're looking a long way off before we're using it clinically, but it's a very powerful idea, and a lot of people I've spoken to don't see any big reason why it shouldn't work.
Ian Sample. The National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain is 60 years old this year. Its alumni include some of the world's finest musicians, including Sir Simon Rattle. Peter Kingston met some of its current members.
While the nation's young people are ambling and shivering back to school and college, 160 teenagers from all over the British Isles have stayed out for an extra week. It's all above board. These are no truants. In fact, they've probably been working harder than most of their friends. They all play in the National Youth Orchestra. The NYO is 60 years old. It brings together some of the finest budding instrumental talent in the country, 3 times a year or so, for intensive rehearsals and concerts. To make this happen, it attracts an impressive list of conductors from this country and from overseas. For the past 4 days, the celebrated Russian-born maestro, Semyon Bychkov, has been preparing these young players for 3 concerts. The menu includes Sinfonia by Luciano Berio and, the piece we're listening to, Richard Strauss's huge Alpine Symphony. In the late spring, Bychkov is coming back to the UK to conduct Wagner's opera Lohengrin at Covent Garden. He's starting off the year, however, in a school hall just outside Uttoxeter in Staffordshire. There's barely enough space to cram in all the players, let alone to swing his bat on. But is he enjoying it?
Of course I'm enjoying myself, otherwise why would I do what I do? But of course what makes it different working with young people is their immediacy in connection to music. It's very touching, in fact, to see how they're discovering it, how they're reacting. You know, it's no different from children who are just literally the toddlers discovering the world. Well, these ones are not toddlers, and in some way, I mean, they're already young adults, but they're discovering music, you know. And through music, they're also discovering more about life and vice versa. So, yes, it's kind of very touching to observe.
But what do the players make of their conductor?
I'm Claire Wicks. I'm 17 and I'm principal flute at the NYO.
And what's it been like working with Semyon?
He's been great and he's got a really individual connection with the whole orchestra. He's absolutely amazing to work with because he really puts emotion into it, and I mean, we've given him back everything that he's put in.
It's going to be quite intense, isn't it? Because you've only got 3 days with him or something like that.
I mean, the rehearsals are always really intense, but it's an incredibly focused atmosphere.
You now must have played under some considerable conductors in your way.
Yeah, absolutely. We've played with Mark Elder, Colin Davis, Vasily Petrenko, amongst many, many others. Semyon is absolutely lovely to play with. But I mean, if I had to pick a favourite conductor, it'd be extremely difficult.
Now in her fourth year with the orchestra, Claire's an NYO veteran. She's used to the concentrated preparation that's needed in an ensemble that meets only 3 times a year. But what's it like for a newcomer?
My name's Graham McKenzie. I'm 17 and it's my first time in the orchestra. I play in the first violin section. It's been very hard going, but it's also been really great at the same time. Met some really nice people and everything. It's good to see all the young musicians wanting to achieve something.
There's no doubt that you have to be pretty nippy on your instrument to get into the National Youth Orchestra, and many of the young players have ambitions to make music their career. Roughly 60% of the membership last year went on to music college, which leaves a sizable percentage who go into other things. And that's exactly as it should be, says their latest conductor.
Those who will not become professional musicians, I'm absolutely sure that having lived through these kind of experiences, music will continue to be a vital element in their life. They won't want to escape it. And finally, that's what it's all about.
Peter Kingston reporting. Phil Maynard and Francesca Panetta produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.